Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Mark O'Shea, MBE. He is a professor of herpetology at the University of Wolverhampton. He has presented numerous television series on snakes for the Discovery Channel, ITV, and BBC, and has conducted a variety of herpetological field projects. But we're talking about his new book, Lizards of the World, A Guide to Every Family. Mark, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks, Mark.
This book does an interesting thing. It introduces you to the families of lizards, and when you look at them, the variety of lizards around the world is breathtaking. Can you talk about that? I mean, it's an amazing group of animals.
Well, the diversity of lizards worldwide is pretty spectacular, and you wouldn't notice that if you living in the U.S. because apart from maybe down in the Southwest, lizards aren't that well represented. There's quite a few states that have just got the odd skink,
And Massachusetts lost their only breeding ones. We used to have breeding five-line skinks in Massachusetts up until the early part of the 20th century. Now we don't even have that.
Was that habitat destruction or...
Habitat. Or habitat destruction. Yeah. Right down the line.
But equally, quite a few of the lizard groups don't actually occur in North America anyway.
That's right.
The diversity in the tropics is obviously greatest. Australia is a very lizard-orientated continent, and there's a lot of rainforest lizards that are specialists in South America, in Africa, and Southeast Asia. So lizards aren't that well represented in the U.S. I mean, you have very, very few geckos there, a few of the eyelid geckos in the Southwest, but when people see geckos over on towards the east, they're mostly introduced house geckos from other parts of the world, which are, of course, very good colonists.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, when I looked at the new Peterson Guide to Reptiles and Amphibians of the United States, I think when you look at Florida, they have a huge number of introduced or released species now, like including tegus and all sorts of other stuff.
Tegus, green iguanas.
Oh, yeah, they're all over.
I mean, they have a problem with green iguanas. Yes, it is a big lizard, and, potentially it could be quite a brutal lizard to native species. Florida is like an open-air zoo.
It's awful.
You don't know what you're going to find.
Oh, no, it's true. Let's talk about lizards in general. Talk to me about lizards and snakes. How closely are they related?
Well, snakes, strictly speaking, snakes are a derived group of lizards. They've come out of the lizards. So we refer to them, they're generally put in a separate suborder, but they really are just highly derived lizards in the same way that the amphisbenians, the worm lizards.
Right.
And you do have one of these, you do have one of these in the U.S. down in Florida.
That's right.
Rhinoera floridana. It's a little worm lizard. And worm lizards are, there's maybe 200, just over 200 species, and they're found in a tropical belt, but they're really strangely distributed. There's two on Cuba, there's three in the Baja California Peninsula and things like that, but there's one in Florida. So they are a legless, by and large, a legless group of reptiles, squamates. The squamata contains the snakes, the lizards, and the amphisbenians, the worm lizards. And these worm lizards have evolved from within the lizards in the same way that the snakes have. But we tend to treat snakes as a separate group, but they've come from the same origins as the lizards.
It's interesting in your book, the trend towards limblessness goes across many different groups of lizards.
Virtually all of them. Sometimes it's very, very subtle.
Yeah.
They
start to get elongate and really long tails.
That. I mean, yes, they do. That comes with it. The two come together. But the first signs would be the loss of a phalange. You know, when you bend your fingers, all the different bones in your fingers. Well, the loss of a phalange so that instead of 3 bones in your finger, you'd only got 2. Well, that's the start of the reduction towards limblessness. And it would be very subtle in things like chameleons or agamas. And you might think, well, chameleons, you can't have legless chameleons. They fall off the branches. But they've got specially adapted zygodactylous feet, like mittens for climbing. But in some species, there's a loss of a phalange. And unless you knew that, you probably wouldn't know. But it counts. But as you look at some of the families, you can see the trend from what people would see as a typical lizard, which is a pentadactyle tetrapod. Tetrapod, 4 legs, pentadactyle, 5 fingers or toes, like us. And they're a typical lizard, is the one that you see running over the rocks and very agile. But within most of the groups, there is a trend from that towards almost or complete limblessness. The loss of the phalanges, then ultimately the loss of the entire digit, so you go from 5 fingers to 4 fingers, then potentially the loss of all of the fingers or the toes, and the shortening of the limbs themselves, so they become more like stubs, and ultimately the total loss.
And some of those in-between forms, which are illustrated beautifully by photography in the book, are really fascinating, like the large-scaled grass lizard. Has no forelimbs, but the hind limbs are now reduced to like a flap.
Yes. Now, you see, the interesting thing is that when you think of limblessness, first off, people think limblessness, it must be primitive because we are pentadactyle tetrapods. But it's not. It's derived. It's advanced. It's an animal evolving for a particular scenario where it is better to have reduced or no limbs. Now, the obvious one is burrowing in the ground.
Yeah,
because you don't need limbs if you're pushing yourself through the substrate, and quite a few desert lizards are sometimes called sandfish, or they swim through the sand like a fish through water. And limbs in some of these lizards are a disadvantage, so it's the obvious one. But the one you just mentioned, that doesn't burrow.
It goes through grasses.
It goes through grass, and the thing you can tell. When you look at a legless or a limbless or almost limbless squamate, whether a snake or a lizard, because, of course, snakes are by and large limbless, but, of course, boas and pythons retain the vestigial spurs as the hind limbs, which the males use for stroking the females during courtship. So they're not totally limbless, boas and pythons. But when you look at them, if the animal has a long tail, it's not a burrower.
That's right.
The short tail ones are the burrowers. They lose the tail as well, because the tail they don't need. The ones that like that, that swims through the grass. And the photograph in the book is one I caught in South Africa, and I was just amazed watching this thing just get motoring through the long grass. It was just perfectly built.
Wow.
Just going through. No, and occasionally, those little stubs, they give a little kick when it caught a grass stalk, you know, poof, just. But of course, it'd be no use for walking at all.
None.
Absolutely useless. So it's evolved, but it's lost something along the way. And the other thing is that's quite interesting about this is when you see species that have they lose their front limbs and then the back limbs. So there's quite a lot of species that have the remains of hind limbs, like the boas and pythons. Like that grass lizard, like the pygopodids, which are an almost limbless group of geckos found in Australia and southern New Guinea. You think geckos, well, they run up the walls. They've got these legs. It's them. But the pygopodids have lost them. And some of those are grass swimmers. Some of those are burrowers. A lot of them have retained just a bit of the hind limb. It's like a scaly flap. And unless you looked, you wouldn't notice it. And again, it's just for giving that little extra kick.
I think one of the weirdest examples, and my brother at the Smithsonian actually studied them for a while, is the Mexican ajolotes or bipedes.
Yes.
What a weird creature that is.
Weird, yes. And I'm glad you got onto that, because that's exactly where I was going next. because what I was about to say is that they lose the front limbs, but sometimes retain the rear limbs. There are very, very, very few squamates, very few animals that have lost the hind limbs but have got the front limbs. And there's 3 species of those bipedes that your brother studied. And I was lucky enough to find and photograph one down at the southern tip of Baja when I was when I was doing my TV series. We got one. I was with Lee Grismer, and he found it in the sand dune because they burrow through the sand. And they are amazing. They're pretty well formed front limbs with five digits on the Bipes biporus. The other ones have four and three digits, but the Bipes biporus has got five fingers. And then after that, the body just goes on and on forever.
It seems like the limbs are shoved really far forward on the body.
For digging, like it's like a mole.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
Yeah.
And some people call them mole lizards and things like that. Do you know they're quite feared in some. Because people, see how I'm going to say this on radio. People are worried about sleeping on the ground because one of these might take advantage, and once it's gone in there, you're not going to get it back out again. Of course, that is an old wives' tale. They don't do that. But somehow the story arose. But they are amazing. Now, apart from them, with their amazing little front feet, and I say to anybody, go and look for a photo of one of these.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the mole lizards or azulay or whatever you want to call them, they really are bizarre. But they're not alone. In the skinks, and the skinks is a big family, they might not be well represented in North America, in the U.S., but there are about 1,600 skinks at least around the world. So it's a big family, probably 1,700 now. And there are a handful, just a handful. There's one genus in Madagascar. There's a handful in India and Thailand that are skinks that have just retained the front limbs, not like bipes, but they've retained front limbs but lost the hind limbs. And if you then want to find other animals that have done the same, the only ones I can think of off the top of my head would be the sirens, which are a group of amphibians.
I had a pet siren for years, a greater siren, Serena lacertina.
There you go. Front limbs, no hind limbs.
Yep, that's exactly right.
It's bizarre. And it's really rare in the animal kingdom. Well, certainly amongst vertebrates, you don't see it. And so you'd be hard-pushed to find anything else.
I know, it's bizarre. Let's talk about some other general things about lizards, because we could just talk about lizard limbs forever.
Yeah, they are.
I have my geriatric snake, Rosie Boa, and she sheds regularly, and she sheds in one huge, long piece. How do lizards shed? Whenever I've had pet lizards or have seen lizards in the wild, it seems like it comes off in pieces.
Well, that's one of the disadvantages of having legs. Isn't it? A snake can shed its skin in one go. Although, in actual fact, strictly speaking, if a snake sheds its skin in one go, all of it, you still get two pieces, because what a lot of people don't realize is that snakes actually shed the skin off their tongues as well.
Oh, wow.
I found, a long time ago, I had some albino cobras, and I was finding the sheds from their tongues in the water bowls.
Whoa. The skin, they're just like a casting of the tongue?
Well, if you think about it, the tongue is a very sensitive organ in a snake. Really, the single most important sense organ. You could argue for pit vipers and pythons and boas with their pits, but for the majority of snakes, the tongue is the most important sense organ. And they're flicking it continually, and it's very, very sensitive. And it comes out of that little... they don't open their mouths to flick their tongues, of course. There's something called a lingual fossa, which is a little gap. It's like a cat flap at the front.
Yep, yep.
And they stick the tongue out of there. And, of course, every time they're doing that, it's potentially abrading against the scales.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
So you'd think that it would lose some sensitivity over time in the same way, you know, we callus up and things like that. So it would make sense for them to. But I never really thought about it until I started to find shed skins. And I don't know why I was finding from the albino cobras. Maybe they were just a bit more obvious. But, they were shedding the skin off this. But getting back to lizards, yes, lizards are going to shed their skins in pieces because they simply can't slither. But I challenge you to put on a greatcoat, button it all up, and then get out of it in one go. It's not easy. And if you've got four limbs in the suit, well, it's a big problem. So they will shed their skin in pieces, yes.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Mark O'Shea, MBE. He's a professor of herpetology at the University of Wolverhampton. He has presented numerous television series on snakes for places like the Discovery Channel, ITV, and the BBC, and has conducted a variety of herpetological field projects, of which I'm totally jealous. And we are talking about his new book, Lizards of the World, A Guide to Every Family. And this brings up the question, there will be a snake companion volume, I hope.
There will.
Okay, good.
What do you think I've been doing through lockdown? I can't go out anywhere. I've got so much writing because I'm writing this. I'm updating my Guide to the Snakes of New Guinea, which is a massive, that's taken 10 years. And I'm writing papers and describing new species. And so, quite frankly, I'm not short of things to occupy my time, and I've been working quite diligently on the sister volume on Snakes of the World. And of course, I've worked with Princeton before. In 2005, they published the U.S. edition of Venomous Snakes of the World. And in 2007, Boas and Pythons of the World. So those were two of my earlier books with them. They were quite different format, different style.
This is a beautiful volume here.
Yeah, I like it. It is a nice book, and I say that myself. Yes.
Well, you mentioned discovering new species. I was surprised. You wrote in this book, in the year 2020, 105 new lizard species were discovered, one worm lizard, and 36 new snake species.
Yes. The understanding of our biodiversity has never been more important.
Yeah.
Today. And we've never had as many tools to enable us to understand what's going on as we do have today. And because of now the molecular methods of identifying species and comparing different populations that are available and working out how far back different groups were related, it's just amazing what can be achieved. And so For young and up-and-coming zoologists and herpetologists, if they think it's all been done, no.
Oh, no.
It's only just starting. Well, you can get right in at the front door and get involved in some amazing biodiversity discoveries. There are a lot of new species. I mean, we've got a paper coming out shortly with a new ground snake, which we collected in East Timor. We're working on a revision of the genus Toxica calamus, which are a New Guinea genus of snakes that I've worked on for a long time, which will have a couple of new species. So new species, yes. It's not as rare as people would think. It does happen, and it's down to the fact that we now are able to really recognize what is and what isn't.
And it also makes preservation of habitat critical. You mentioned in this book, in one sandridge site in Victoria Desert in Australia, there are 53 species of lizards found in that one area. So you can imagine that the destruction of habitat has to be the major threat.
Well, I watched the fires with horror.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, I can't imagine what the fires that are happening here in the western part of the state, that is doing to the herps.
And think back, I mean, of course, first off, what it's doing to the people, they're losing their lives, their livelihoods, and everything. People are trying to prevent those sort of losses, but of course they still occur and they're tragic. So I don't want to sort of say, oh, that doesn't matter, it's all about the animals, but remember the fires in New South Wales?
Yeah.
And if you look at a field guide to the reptiles and amphibians of New South Wales, or you looked at a field guide to the reptiles and amphibians of California and Oregon and Washington, and you start to see that some of the populations and some of the actual species or subspecies have got very small ranges.
Right. That's exactly right.
And if a fire goes through there, you're in danger of extinctions if it's the whole species that goes, or extirpations if it's the loss of a population that also occurs somewhere else. And some of these species, the populations, they'll never recover. There won't be enough left, even if some survive the fire. And the fact that fire suppression, we've done a lot we stop fires. We just fire suppression. But the trouble with fire suppression is fire is a natural part of the environment, and it does occur. Who was suppressing them before man was walking around? There were fires. And if you suppress fires for a long time, when you do get one that you can't suppress, it burns for longer,
That's
deeper,
right.
hotter, because there's so much more material ready to burn. And so trees that are adapted to withstand a fast-moving fire moving through an area and scorching their bark and carrying on, and then clearing the ground for the seeds to germinate because there's plenty of light, well, when the fire lingers around for too long, it burns not off just scorch the bark, it burns the bark off, and it starts to burn the hardwood, and you've got dead trees. So, and it's not just reptiles and amphibians, it's the birds that nest there, it's,
right.
you know, the number of koalas that were lost in the fires in New South Wales.
I've been there, and it frightens me incredibly. And although I went there to look at birds, I ended up being totally fascinated by the herp species there. I ended up walking across large lizards across roads all the time so they wouldn't get run over. So like blue-tongued skinks and frilled lizards,
yeah.
I'd pick them up and then walk them. Speaking of which, let's talk about lizards in general. The largest one living today is the Komodo dragon.
Yeah,
and I think not
largest and heaviest, but Salvador's monitor lizard may grow longer because it's an arboreal lizard with a very long tail.
But historically, in human times, there was a lizard that lived in Australia.
Yeah, Megalania.
Yeah, that seemed like a lizard to deal with.
It's the largest lizard that we've known to exist because. Dinosaurs are not just big extinct lizards. They're not. Dinosaurs are more closely related to crocodiles and birds
right.
than they are to lizards. It's a different branch. So, you know, yeah, you might go, well, Brontosaurus was a pretty big lizard. Well, yeah, but it wasn't a lizard. but Megalania was. And they're not really sure, A, how big it actually got. There's various discussions about size, just as there are for T-Rex, how big it really got. And similarly, they're not sure exactly when it went extinct, but it could have been, it could have interacted with the first humans who arrived in Australia. There's a strong potential for an overlap there, and that would potentially mean that either people hunted it because it was good to eat, or people hunted it because it was a competitor, or people hunted it because it was a threat.
That's how big it was.
Yeah, it was big. It was big, yes. It really made makes the Komodo dragon look a little bit sort of small.
Now, most lizards lay eggs. Some are viviparous. But a few species, and this has always knocked me out when I learned this, reproduce parthenogenically. Genetically.
Yeah, good
explain that, because that's okay. Amazing to me that happens.
Well, there's two kinds of parthenogenesis. And I don't want to frighten people with big words, but there's facultative parthenogenesis, and that's when a species that's normally sexual reproduces. The females have got no males, and they it's a last-ditch attempt to reproduce. And that's happened in quite a few sexual species. It's happened in Komodo dragons. It happened at London and Chester Zoos. In the Komodo dragons, females just produced eggs in the absence of a male. It's happened with, we had a green anaconda that had never been with a male, and she gave birth to 8 neonates, 3 alive, 5 dead, and they're all female. And it's happened in rattlesnakes, it's happened in garter snakes, and it's happened in pythons, depending which group it's in. In pythons and anacondas, they're all female. I think in rattlesnakes, garter snakes, more advanced snakes, they're always all male. But that's facultative parthenogenesis. We're not really talking about that. We're talking about obligate parthenogenesis, and that is when the species is always virgin birth. There are no males. There's only one snake. that does, that's an obligate pathogen, and that's the flowerpot snake, the Bromley blind snake, and it's turned up all over the world because it gets into the
flowerpots
plants,
yeah,
and gets shipped everywhere. Horticultural plants, crop plants, turns up everywhere. I found them halfway up a mountain in East Timor, in the garden of the former governor, where he'd had some plants imported, and they'd come in the root balls, and they'd establish a nice little colony. But lizards wise, there's quite a few.
Including here in the southwest, here,
yeah.
There's...
Yeah, down in the southwest and into Mexico, some of the whip-tailed racer lizards.
Yep.
The one on Aruba is, I believe, parthenogenetic. There are quite a few. There are a few geckos out in the Pacific, and that makes them really, really good colonizers, because one of these geckos gets into somebody's canoe or in a box of... food that they're rowing from island one to island two to sell at the market, and pops out and gets there and starts a new colony, because there's no need for them to put their lonely hearts out in the local serpentine or lizard newspaper. They just go, oh, I like it here, I think I'll reproduce, and that's it.
But what about genetic diversity?
Well, limited, and that's why, although they're good colonizers, they're not going to be good competitors. And when
a sexual
species arrives, it potentially can outcompete them. Amongst the house geckos, there's gone the Indo-Pacific house gecko, Hemidactylus garnotti, is a great colonizer. And we've found them in various locations where they've made sort of beachhead landings and established. But when the common house gecko, Hemidactylus frenatus, or the flat-tailed house gecko, Hemidactylus platyurus, turn up, they're sexual species, and garnotti disappears. So,
wow.
You know, they make the beachhead, but if somebody else arrives, they don't seem to do so well against them. But it is quite fascinating that they're able to do this. And this is why, there are several, Hemidactylus garnotti has established in southeastern USA.
Oh, Mark, we're completely out of time.
Oh, dear.
I know, we could talk about this book for hours, and we're just talking about the introduction, and I want to strongly recommend this book. It's a beautiful book, and the color photography is state-of-the-art, and to see these animals reproduced is just mind-boggling. My guest tonight has been Mark O'Shea, MBE. He's a professor of herpetology at the University of Wolverhampton and has presented numerous television series on snakes for the Discovery Channel, ITV, BBC, and has conducted a variety of herpetological field projects, but we've been talking about his new book, Lizards of the World, A Guide to Every Family. It is a beautiful book. Mark, I hope we get to talk again.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.